This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm Carol Crist. I'm the director of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. And I first want to say thank you to The Matrix for co-sponsoring this program. And I am really thrilled that we have with us today Jorge Clor de Alva. Jorge has a very unusual career. He has moved through many of the sectors of higher education. He was a professor at Princeton. He was a professor here at Berkeley in anthropology and in ethnic studies. And then he went over to what some people think of as the dark side. He became the president of the University of Phoenix. And then after that, headed the Apollo group. So he has seen higher education very much up close from two places in higher education that people rarely co-inhabit. One, an elite public flagship university, also an elite private before that, and then the largest and in some ways the most creative of the for-profit universities. Since leaving the Apollo group, he has headed up a not-for-profit a research organization and think tank, the Nexus Research and Policy Center, right? It's from that position that this work on endowments and taxing endowments has come. Jorge has at his heart a passionate belief in access and equity, and this is one of the projects that's related to that passion. It's very controversial work. I hope we have some spirited discussion afterwards. Jorge is going to talk for about a half an hour, then I'm going to ask him some questions, and then you'll have a chance to ask him some questions. So, Jorge.
I want to begin by
by giving you a little bit of a sense of the aim of this study, how it came about. First, was the question of free community college, and we had been discussing the question of affordability for quite some time and wondering how best to address it. And when Obama came out with free community college and started making a great big thing about it, we were very concerned. In no small part, we were very concerned because we had just finished a study of 700 community colleges, which we studied one by one. And in those 700 community colleges, we also did the unthinkable. We actually ranked them publicly in terms of the return on investment for graduates, that is, students who had completed an AA degree. What was the financial return on investment? And we realized that while for students that attended some schools, it was very good, but for students who attended many other schools, it was, in fact, not only bad, they would have made more money had they simply not gone to community college and had instead just gone to work immediately after they finished high school or their GED. Anyway, we were very concerned about that. The other reason that we did this study is because we saw that there was a very low, in our study and in the study of many others, we noticed a very low student success rate in most community colleges. And that's, I won't say straight across the board, but across very many community colleges. And I want to go back to free community college for a second. We also realized that while Obama's heart was in the right place, it was politically impossible to get this done. It was just not politically feasible, and particularly since he wanted to do it by quote-unquote taxing the rich, and that's something that under a Republican administration was just not going to happen. We also picked on an important part of Obama's presentation of free community colleges, saying that beyond free community college, that there ought to be real support mechanisms in order to make college a successful thing. Now, most people, the media didn't pick up on that, but we certainly picked up on it, and we realized, as, along with others, that access without support is simply not opportunity. And then having done this, we began to study, let's look at endowments as a point of departure. And we quickly, in our research, we realized that the tax-exempt nature of endowments at large institutions represented a subsidy, a per-student subsidy to those institutions that was substantially larger than the appropriations received by public institutions, by many public institutions. So after undergoing that kind of analysis, we began to think, now we know that, and so what? And so when we got into the process of figuring out, because all of our research is policy-oriented, we always come up with recommendations, and so what's the recommendation here? And we suggested that endowments ought to be taxed, and I'll explain what I mean by that soon. So let me begin by speaking to the issue of the hidden public cost of private nonprofit colleges. First of all, as I was mentioning, there's this perverse distribution of taxpayer support. That is, although these institutions receive relatively little in terms of direct subsidies from the government, other than for research, et cetera, and certainly in financial aid, and I'm not speaking to that issue, we realized that having such a huge disparity in the amount of money that is being put out for private institutions versus the public institutions, there was something wrong from a public policy perspective. And what we saw was, as I note here, the taxpayer support of wealthy private colleges was invisible. In fact, this is a topic that seems obvious, but hadn't been spoken about very much. Even when Senator Chuck Grassley, back in 2008, was proposing that universities have to pay out their endowment at a 5% rate, because most institutions don't do that, that's all he was suggesting. He was not suggesting a tax. And indeed, the only place where we found any precedent for an actual political proposal for a tax was in the state of Massachusetts. So in the state of Massachusetts, as recently as last year, the legislature is still proposing a 2.5% tax on endowments over $1 billion. So there is a precedent, and it happens to be in Massachusetts, of all places. So this table summarizes our research. And just to look at a couple of examples, first let me take the average. So what we did is we looked at 10 universities with the biggest endowments, but in 10 different states. Then we looked at their flagship institutions, and then we looked at their comprehensive universities that were nearby comprehensive universities, and then we looked at the largest community colleges that were nearby to see what the distribution was. And on average, out of the 60 schools that we studied, because we also studied some schools that were medium-sized endowments and small endowments, but I'm not going to discuss those here. Anyway, the average per FTE, and here I mean both graduate and undergraduate, so taking into consideration both graduate and undergraduates, and we're looking at full-time equivalent students, the average subsidy that they received in these 10 schools was about $41,000 per year. This is a subsidy based on the tax exemption that they have. The university, for flagship universities, about $15,000. For comprehensive universities, about $6,700. For community colleges, about $5,100. And the reason it's even that high as an average of $5,100 in part has to do with California, because California students basically don't pay tuition for community college, and so consequently the state subsidies is obviously very high. If you look at, for instance, let's say the outlier in the group is my old school, Princeton, where annually the subsidy per student is $105,000. That's a handsome chunk of money. and compare that to Rutgers University at 12,000, Montclair at 4,700, and Essex Community College near Montclair, and indeed near Princeton at $2,400. This is obviously the widest disparity, because Princeton has such a huge endowment, but only about 8,000 students. If you look at California, which is, you know, a particular interest to us here, and you look at Stanford, Stanford students get $6,300. And I want to add something here. This is $63,000 subsidy without counting, I'm not talking about anything having to do with financial aid, and I'm not counting here, very importantly, what are called pilots. So there are payments in lieu of paying their real estate taxes. If you add that to Stanford, it adds up to about another $6,000 that each student gets. So compare that to what Berkeley gets, about $10,500. Compare that to Cal State Fullerton, 4,000, and Fullerton College, again, is higher, once again, because in the state of California, community college is essentially free. So anyway, out of this disparity came the issue for us of, you know, what to do about it. So if you look at this hidden public cost of private, nonprofit colleges, it really is a form of welfare to the wealthy. So here you see the subsidy for the 10 highest endowment colleges is 3 times the subsidy for the flagships, 6 times the subsidy for the regionals, 8 times the subsidy for the community colleges. And very importantly, these schools, the public schools in all three of these sectors, they have to fight it out. To get whatever they get, they have to fight it out with all sorts of other constituencies, with all sorts of competitors at the political level, and it's all very public. Whereas at the level of this elite institutions with large endowments, you don't even know it's there. Nobody's even talking about it. That is, until now, that we have managed to precipitate a lot of conversation on the topic. And again, I want to point out that we're not taking into consideration the big problem of property taxes. And I'll tell you why we're not taking it into consideration. Since they're tax exempt, most institutions don't assess the value of their property. And certainly the county or the municipality within which they exist and would have been paying taxes, they also don't assess it because it's an expensive thing to do. And what for? They don't pay taxes. So if you take a look at Stanford here, according to the Santa Clara County Assessor's Office last year, Stanford University has about $8 billion in assessed valuation, in what would be assessable valuation on which they would have to pay taxes. Well, this adds up to about $555,000 per student, which translates into another $6,000 taxpayer subsidy per student. So on top of the $63,000, you can add another $6,000 if we were to take this into consideration. In the case of Harvard, and as you may or may not know, Harvard's physical plant is primarily in the city of Cambridge, whereas Cambridge, since they practically own the city, there's not much discussion there about the taxes that they owe. But Boston, who's very concerned about the fact that Harvard has also a chunk of real estate in Boston, they assess their taxes so that they're liable. This was back in 2009, which is the only data that we have for them. They assess their taxes at $40 million. And so they would have been paying $38 million in net tax breaks that they're getting, which adds up to another $1,800 per student. And then when they were assessed by Boston, I'll just share this with you. Despite the fact that they have the tax exemption, despite the fact that there's all the town and gown discussion between Boston and Harvard, they only paid like about 5% of what they were voluntarily called upon to pay with regards to on a pilot basis, that is a payment in lieu of taxes. The next issue that we were concerned with is, okay, so we know that endowments do a lot of good things, and certainly for the people that are at the institution, whether they be the students there, the faculty there, or people who can take advantage of the things that the institution sponsors, whether it's museum, theater, whatever might be the case. But there's another aspect to growing inequality that we wanted to analyze here, and that is the relationship between the size of endowment and the Pell participation rates. And there we saw another perverse pattern, which I'm sure that, you know, like much social science, is just common sense. Yes, you can imagine there are very few students that receive Pell grants within these rich schools. But we looked at them one by one, and we can summarize it this way. 14% of those elite institutions have Pell grants. 14% of the students, on average, at those elite institutions are Pell Grant eligible, versus 41% in the community colleges and 38% in the regional campuses. The point that I'm making here, here you can see it graphically laid out. In other words, the bigger the endowment, the lower the percentage of Pell students. So one could complain and say, well, wait a minute, but they're giving so much money in financial aid, right? Well, fortunately, you know, this is like from a Woody Allen movie. This morning, a study came out. The study based on the Department of Education's recently released data on the finances for the institutions and the finances of the students vis-a-vis affordability, et cetera, et cetera. And they showed that among the 60 wealthiest institutions, private schools in the United States, those 60 schools, the average debt that a graduate who would be Pell Grant eligible comes out with is $20,000. That means that they are coming out with an average debt, if I can speak to the University of Phoenix, they're coming out with an average debt that's higher than the average debt of a student that had gone to the University of Phoenix, just to put the two in comparison here. So it is not necessarily the case that they're spending so much money on financial aid. And furthermore, to avoid in the debate the issue that some of this money is going to financial aid, so why are you beating up on endowments? In fact, we're proposing that all appropriations that an institution makes in financial aid for needy students that would be Pell eligible students, that be able to be offset against their tax liability. So what we're also hoping is that they will increase the amount of money that they would be spending on financial aid at those institutions, because why not? It would be better from a policy perspective internally to spend that money on increasing financial aid than to be paying it in taxes. Okay, so will free tuition in community colleges lead to student success? So, you know, I already began discussing this problem. Well, needless to say, community colleges could use all the help they can get. I think that's obvious. We know that additional financial aid, because of what I've been trying to say and what our research and the other research of others have laid out, it's clear that it's not needed. First of all, most community college is, for people who are needy, is free, regardless of the state where you're at. The average cost of community college across the United States is about $3,000. But about 70% of the students that are needy already go to community college at paying either nothing or no more than about $1,000. So still, with that, community colleges have not been doing a very good job. And in one of the best studies on the subject, and I just summarize it this way, 50% of low-income students who started college okay? Not students who are thinking of going to college. 50% of low-income students who started college are not finishing community college. This is in community colleges. So clearly, expanding access, absent some, as we're suggesting, some proven student support service, is poor public policy, because they become even bigger cemeteries of the hopes and dreams of people by simply expanding them without providing adequate services. So we'll, again, to continue this, what we're suggesting, and this is the complicated part, and this is the part that, in fact, Carol has helped us with by connecting us with some of the lawyers that are familiar with some of these tax issues. What we are proposing, after a lot of research and a lot of discussion with tax specialists, is that the money that is taken, that the government, that the IRS identifies on the basis of the tax, the progressive tax that we are suggesting, which goes from about 0.5% to 2%, which, by the way, has a precedent. That is, foundations already have to pay 1-2% on earned income. So this is not coming out of the blue. But universities don't. And what we're suggesting is about the same range, that money be taken and transformed into a tax credit structure, so that it works something like this. Let's say Facebook wants to give $1 million to San Francisco City College. So Facebook's tax liability is, let's say, $10 million. They can give $1 million to San Francisco City College and take a tax credit of $1 million from what they would owe. And in doing that, we get around the political issue that, instead of raising money for community colleges in order to be able to do the job they have to do in terms of student support, in order to raise that money in a way that is revenue neutral, so that the Republicans can get on board, the money that is raised on one side is offset by the money that is then owed to the federal government on the other side by institutions that want to take advantage of these tax credits. So on the one hand, we're making it revenue neutral. On the other hand, we're moving the money. We're suggesting how to move the money from the taxed institutions directly to the community colleges, and therefore going around all of the prohibitions against lockups right now in the federal government. That is, that you cannot raise a tax and then say this tax is going to be for this purpose. So to keep that from happening and to make it revenue neutral, that's what we're suggesting, that a tax credit be created. I've already made my point here. How could this needed educational services be paid for? Well, here's what Politico says after reviewing our study. Tax Harvard. I'm all for that. How can this be done? Okay, two suggestions. First, you got to make the hidden study—excuse me—the hidden subsidies public. And right now, they are not. The reason we have undertaken the research we did on how much of a subsidy is taking place, the way we did it, it's because we don't have access. Nobody has access to what the actual earned income on endowments is of these wealthy institutions. Once again, it is the legislature of Massachusetts, of all places, that has put in a transparency bill to force the endowments in the state of Massachusetts to have to show all how they're investing, how much money they're making from those investments, how they're spending that money, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's a very complicated bill. But the first thing that we're suggesting is that the federal government has to step in and to make these hidden subsidies public, because that I think is very important from a public policy perspective. The second is, as I mentioned, to tax large endowments. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, here's a breakdown of what we're suggesting. And again, keeping in mind that foundations are already taxed 1 to 2% of earned income. So what we're suggesting is that institutions with less than $500 million in taxes, that they be taxed at 0.5%, and you can see the rest. You can see the number of institutions involved, and you can see the amount of money that would have been raised in 2014. It would have been about $5 billion, which, by the way, is about 85% of what Obama says is needed to have free community college across the United States. So it's not an insignificant amount, although I know for some of you it's an insignificant amount. Now, who would be affected? First of all, very few colleges. 20 of those colleges account, the misdistribution of endowment money is so great that only 20 institutions would account for 84% of the revenue, of that tax revenue. And they educate less than 2% of all students in the U.S., graduate and undergraduate. So very few students would be affected. In fact, 95 schools that would have had to pay taxes in 2014, they together only educate about 5% of all the students. And as we are suggesting, the tax should be able to be offset by the amount that the institution spends on financial aid, not in general, but financial aid to low-income students. And so let's take an example, and maybe, Carol, you can point out to the example from Smith. But at Vassar, that also got a lot of very good publicity this morning, for the same reason I'm going to say, at Vassar, last year they spent $60 million in financial aid for needy students. But their tax liability, according to this scheme here, would have only been about $5 million. So they'd be far from having to pay anything in terms of taxes. And so I mentioned already that our plan is to be revenue neutral, so that not only revenue neutral, but able to direct the revenue to improve community colleges. How? We're suggesting that the following be done. As I mentioned before, let the IRS figure out how much in taxes what the tax liability would be. Then match that tax credit to the money that would be available for community colleges to be able to compete on competitive grants in order to establish within their institutions proven, effective student service mechanisms that we know have worked in community colleges in order to improve student success. And what we're suggesting is that a number of things would result from this. One is that it would be the community colleges that could help to identify the corporate institutions that might want to take advantage of this tax credit, and that would help to promote college corporate links, which are obviously very important in order to get employability to where it needs to be for those community college graduates. And by doing it the way that we're suggesting, we have managed to get to the following point, where conceivably, that is, politics being what it is, I'm just going to say conceivably, I'm not even going to say expected, but we just might have a hearing on this in the Oversight Committee of the House Ways and Means as early as this fall, because we have the Republicans on board with this because of the tax revenue neutrality here. In other words, you can't claim that it's raising taxes because in fact the total amount of tax would not be raised at all. And so we're hoping that by getting the word out, you getting the word out, if you support all of this, that this is ultimately going to happen. And some people must think it's ultimately going to happen because the first two media to interview me when we first came out with our report was the Crimson at Harvard and the Daily Princetonian. And so obviously they were very concerned already. And yesterday, day before yesterday when I was on NPR discussing this issue, they were all invited to participate in it, and none of them wanted to touch it. And so I think we're on the right track. So that's that. Noel, thank you.
So, Jorge, as you know, I find this a very provocative idea, but I had a number of questions. I wanted to just start off the questioning, and then I'll throw it open to all of you. Private schools with very large endowments are largely research universities, not all of them, but most of them. And as you know, it's a hard problem in college and university budgeting to separate what supports research from what supports instruction. And you could at least make the claim that research universities in their research capacity, as opposed to their instructional capacity, are serving the public good. And that part of what these endowments do is support that research capacity. So how would you answer that argument in defense of your plan?
Well, this is an argument that that really speaks to the broader defense on the part of these institutions, that not only their research, but many other things that they do are in the public good. And I think that's the case. We could, for instance, argue for a policy that excludes research funding, and therefore more money would go into research within the institution itself rather than pay taxes. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the same way as you are incenting the institution to spend more money on financial aid, you could incent them to, I mean, tax policy, after all, is a creation of incentives.
Yeah.
You could incent them to spend more on research. Where I have difficulty with that is that most of the research money comes from outside the institution.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely the case that some of it comes from the endowments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more true even in public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But most of it comes from outside, and we're not taking that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could do a trade-off, and you pay property taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, because if I were Harvard's lawyer or Princeton's lawyer, I think that's one of the first places that I would go for an argument, is saying the endowment supports much more than student instruction, but rather the enormous research capacity, which isn't just the direct funding of research, but it is, you know, the laboratories, the technicians, the centers.
Absolutely. But let me say that because we are hopefully young in years and judgment old,
mm-hmm.
We didn't get into that in mm-hmm. any of our research.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's ultimately a policy debate we don't want to take on.
Uh-huh.
What we want to take on is essentially an excise tax debate.
Uh-huh.
So it is independent of how much money they make. The difference between one year and another's tax increase would determine what that tax would be. And if the institutions don't want to do it that way, then they have to be transparent.
Yeah.
About how they run their endowments. And I don't think very many institutions would be interested in doing that.
Yeah.
Because these are huge.
Yeah.
These are huge endowments. And I just have to share with you that if Princeton decides to make a particular move in terms of its investments, you can be assured that Wall Street is on top of it, and plenty of investors would follow them on that. So they have no interest in telegraphing what it is they're going to be investing in.
Yeah. And another question that I have relates to public university endowments. And I was, you know, this just happened to come in the mail when I was thinking the Chronicle of Higher Education Almanac. And in just the top 25 endowments, University of Texas System, $25 million, Texas A&M, $11
million, billion.
University of Michigan, billion, sorry, University of Michigan, $9 billion, University of California, $7 billion, University of Virginia, about $6 billion, Ohio State, $3.5 billion. So, how would you? I'm interested in and how you would think about those very large public university endowments.
Well, let me quote Carol Chris on this.
Okay,
she says that in the public institutions, a lot of that money goes to offset the loss in funding, mm-hmm. In appropriations from, yeah. from the state. So, given that, mm-hmm. we decided not to touch the publics,
uh-huh.
and just focus on endowments of large private institutions. And I would go beyond what Carol Chris said, which mm-hmm. was very good, it was useful, and we quoted you.
Yeah,
I would go beyond that and say, well, they're public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we going to tax the Department of Defense? I'm all in favor of it. Probably you are too. But it's an odd thing to think that we're yeah. going to tax what's already being paid for by taxpayers.
I guess what I was suggesting is a kind of refinement to your analysis that if you were going to not touch this, I wonder whether you should add the per student benefit of that endowment to the public subsidy of the state institutions.
But that's
hard. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, but that's very, very, that requires the institutions to generate data they're unwilling to generate.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, a lot of this is the fact, yeah. folks, this is hidden stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge, subsidy by taxpayers like you and me
yeah.
that you don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't. It's hidden.
Yeah. I think you already answered my third question, which is I was wondering why the complexity of the bond mechanism and why not straight redirection. But you really explained that you can't target tax revenues for a specific purpose.
No, you can't.
So this is the way in which you're
right.
you're doing that.
And so we're using the precedents. We couldn't use a bond precedent, which
yeah.
was one we discussed earlier. What we were hoping to do is use a precedent of tax bonds, but that was not possible for a number of reasons. And so consequently, with the lawyers that we've been working with, they suggest that it be straightforward a tax credit because there's plenty of precedent for that.
Yeah.
In other words, you have tax credits to stimulate, you know, a certain part of Oakland, let's say, to get businesses into Oakland where they don't have to pay all their taxes, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's a lot of precedent for tax
mm-hmm.
credits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. The other thing is kind of a curiosity. It would be really interesting to find out what the benefit would be if you subtracted financial aid. It just would be fascinating to try to figure out how much.
Well, after speaking to your
yeah.
your former peer at Vassar, the president at Vassar.
Oh, Cappy Hill, yeah.
After speaking with Cappy, I realized that, and she raised the issue. Look, Jorge, what is it that you really want to do? Do you want to just increase the amount of money that institutions put into financial aid,
mm-hmm.
because ultimately, like Vassar, they'd end up not paying anything?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you really want to raise money for community colleges to do a better job? I want to do both. You know, but I realize it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
And but I don't want the institutions to be attacking this initiative on the basis that but a lot of money the money from the endowments goes to financial aid.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to say isn't really a question, though I'd be interested in your comments on it. You know, you could argue that the submerged state is precisely the point, that higher education is quasi-governmental, and its purpose is to maintain and regulate status hierarchies. So you could argue that that's in fact the purpose of it. It's not that you're exposing something that's not the purpose of it.
Yeah, I would have to put on my old Berkeley hat.
Uh-huh.
Because if I were still teaching here and had my Berkeley hat, that's the argument I would be making. In fact, this is meant to weaken. Weaken the structure that maintains the hierarchization of the society in the U.S. It's meant to do that. It's meant to do that by improving the state of community college students, by making them more successful, because there would be real resources to help community college. Many more community colleges could be like Foothill. Foothill's a superb community college, but most are not.
But it's such an interesting situation, I think, in the United States right now, where the pyramid or the status hierarchy of institutions of higher education has gotten much steeper. The rich have gotten richer.
Absolutely.
And with the expansion of access, you have a much broader base of the pyramid. So it is, so you have...
So you have a worsening in this.
You have a
situation.
Worsening. I think there's a worsening situation, not a situation that's
getting
better.
Yeah, there is. This is meant to address some part of that. And $5 billion is a significant amount of money if you have it available for programs that work in community colleges.
Yeah, but it depends so much of Obama's proposal and also what you're arguing depends on whether you think that community colleges are a door to opportunity or the lowest part in the status hierarchy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, if you don't give a damn about community colleges, there's no argument. I cannot persuade you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.